Dr. Raymond Hamdan, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. He's here to take your questions on those personal problems affecting your life today. Are you experiencing mood swings, depression, anxiety, or relationship issues? Dr. Raymond's on hand to offer guidance and advice. Have you been or are you currently the carer of someone who is ill? Does your partner suffer from depression? Are you the go-to person for people's problems? The stress and emotional strain placed on the person there to support the other through their illness can be isolating, lonely, and even go on to make them ill. There's the saying, who cares for the carer? We begin today by looking at the psychological role of the carer, the people who help and look after the mentally ill, whether they be partners, family members, or professionals. How is a carer affected by the person with the illness? What support do they need? And how is it for a person to see a loved one change in their behaviour and retreat, withdraw into their own world, and even become abusive? Now, in your practice at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, when somebody comes to see you, and of course they can come and visit you for a multitude of reasons, but for example, if somebody comes to see you because they're suffering from depression, how often, I know you do group therapy, but how often do you start to see the person that's closest to that individual starting to perhaps go downhill as well, starting to feel and suffer because they are coping with their partner or family member's illness?
Usually when we see people, we're seeing them as individuals, and we determine in the first session what angle needs to be helping them best. Now, people do function differently. People come in with different depressions. There's no such thing as two depressions being alike. Even though we have guidelines that defines the clinical depression as well as exogenous depressions, we still know that there are individual differences. When we're looking at people who are, for instance, caretakers for others, we're looking at a personality structure here. Not just anyone can be a caregiver or a caretaker. Certain personalities that are involved will involve people who are very empathetic, they're self-sacrificing, very generous. They're also perfectionist, usually, and they look for others' needs before their own. Well, that means that they're not going to be very comfortable with any kind of conflict because they're doing a favor for others. Now, the unconscious process is different than what looks conscious. Many people will think of that individual as such a wonderful person who is so giving and loving, they should be awarded something for all the wonderful things that they're doing for others. But unconsciously, there may be a mechanism that could even be narcissistic, which means that that narcissistic character is playing out as if to be a caregiver. And this is where it's very important that when you hire people to be caretakers or caregivers, that there be some sort of a professional involvement to do assessment and diagnosing so that damage can't be done. Usually with this unconscious process, it's not always dangerous, but it's better to be cautious. Always make sure that you know exactly who it is that you're working with. Many times you don't think about it because it's a family member, and that family member may have had even a symbiotic relationship with the ailing person. The symbiotic relationship is like a seesaw effect. And you see this, for instance, in eating disorders, the symbiotic relationship. One member of the family gets fat, the other gets thin. When the thin one gets fat, the fat one gets thin. So it becomes a seesaw kind of effect.
Why is that, Dr. Raymond?
Well, the symbiotic relationship is based on a personality disorder process in which there is narcissism involved. As a matter of fact, one of the characteristics that is seen in the family dynamics of caretakers and caregivers is someone in the family may have been a narcissistic personality, which is a pretty dangerous character, more likely a borderline personality disorder. So from the time the individual is very, very young and can interact with the personality disordered parent, for instance, they've learned you'd better take care of this person because if you don't, there's going to be hell to pay. Because that person who suffers from histrionic personality disorder, narcissistic or borderline personality disorder, teaches the people in their environment, you'd better agree with me even when I'm wrong, than to put up with my wrath for having disagreed.
So, I know we've kind of leapt really into quite, not necessarily an extreme, because it's certainly a real scenario, but where it can go terribly wrong and not realising perhaps for the wider family what could be happening in a relationship between a caregiver, caretaker and the person that is ill. So just to focus on that a little bit more, is it the case then that perhaps through becoming the caretaker, they have found a power, a control, a way of playing out a certain role that they perhaps haven't been able to play before?
Yes, and this is obviously seen in marriage situations. When, and I will use the typical stereotype image, and it doesn't mean that all men are bad and women are wonderful, or vice versa, that women are bad and men are wonderful. But when a woman has been in some way abused by her husband, let me give you just that as an example, and the man grows older and becomes somewhat feeble, can't take care of themselves mentally or physically, she may still remain an obedient wife, if you'll allow me to use that term. Mm-hmm. I have my tongue in my cheek,
by the way. I am wincing a little bit, I have to say.
So what she'll do during mealtime is she'll take a tray of food to him. And she just happens to place it on his table a little bit more than his arm's length. Now, he can't talk. He can't interact. So she comes back an hour later, says, oh, you're not hungry. Okay. So she takes the food, dumps it out. He can't tell her that he's starving or that he wants water or food. So this is her passive-aggressive way, and we don't even use that term anymore, but the passive-aggressive fashion of getting back at the old boy for having abused her.
And clearly this could happen the other way as well.
I mean,
of course. Is interesting, isn't it? And terribly, terribly sad, the idea that when somebody is unable to speak for themselves or care for themselves, that abuse could be happening. And this is one scenario that could develop within the caregiving situation. And there might be other reasons as well. It could be that as resentment and as one's life has had to change quite drastically to take care of the husband or wife, maybe it's
a child taking care of the parent.
The child taking care of the parent. There might be a financial strain burden that has now been placed on that situation as well because of the illness. And also, I think what I'm interested in as well is the changes you see in the individual. So you have to start with somebody watching this person they love or hopefully love change if they're going through a mental illness or they're going through a medical illness, a physical illness, whatever it may be. If it's old age, you're seeing them go through this change where they're not the person you knew them to be. How you deal with that, and then the duty, you feel this pressure, this responsibility, this everyone's looking at me to step up and be the caregiver. And as you said at the beginning, not everybody is designed for that, and then that's very difficult, what people have got to sort of reconcile with within themselves.
In either case, you deal with the guilt for not wanting to do it, because everybody's supposed to want to take care of the person that they love. However, correctly said, people do have limitations. And it doesn't always have to be because you have an anger issue with that individual and you don't want to take care of them. But it does have to do with maybe your personality style, that you don't have the patience. And this is where you hire people to help. But that doesn't mean that you should not have any interaction with the loved one. It just means that you're not necessarily the caregiver, the caretaker on the physical side of things, but you may sit there with them and talk if you can talk with them, or even if they can't talk, you might tell them stories. It's very important to recognize the personality of the caregiver, because today there are actually psychologists who specialize in working with people who are caretakers and caregivers, realizing the kind of pain and distress that they do go through. People sometimes put their life on hold because their mother is dying. So every day they go to work. After work, they famously go to the nursing home and take care of their mom. This is a story we hear about quite a bit. And they do that for 5 years, 12 years, until mom dies. And then when mom dies, the person somehow feels relieved, but they won't admit it because you're not supposed to feel relieved. That's something you can tell your psychologist. We understand that, but it's not something you want to tell the lawyer when he's reading off the will. But the truth is that sometimes we do feel relieved. Well, because that relief, we feel the guilt, because we're not supposed to feel relieved that the person we care about died. What happens then is the person realizes that they have to continue their life. But from where do they continue it? It certainly isn't that day. They've got to continue it from 10 years ago or 12 years ago or 5 years ago, whenever the caregiving started. So people will put their lives on hold. Now, when we look at this psychologically, are they doing it because it's an obligation, or maybe it's an excuse not to have to even get into a relationship?
We'll explore that and more when we come back. And Dr. Raymond Hamdan, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, looking for some advice when it comes to depression, anxiety, and of course, relationship issues are something we talk a lot about on the show. We're looking at the carer to begin with, and what that means to care for somebody that is ill. Now, whether it's a mental illness, whether it's a cancer, a physical illness, whatever it may be, it could be an elderly parent. What strain does that put on your relationship, and what strain does that put on you as the carer? What can you share? What can you say? How do you find your release? Where do you find your respite and support? What kind of support should be there for the carer as well as the patient? I've got a story for you here from Sally, sharing her experiences of living with a mental illness. She says, I've been a carer for my mum for almost 1 year. She was in a nursing home. My brothers and sisters put her there, but my mother said to me when I visited, please take me home. And so I did. I took my mother home and I looked after her, and I would take her everywhere with me as well to keep an eye on her. I was fit enough to take care of my mum, although I too have a disability, but I managed. She wasn't the easiest of people to look after. She would criticise and would never really appreciate what I was doing for her. But she also had a good sense of humour, and there was things that we did together that I still remember today that I hold dear. She goes on to talk about her mother having asthma as well, and shortness of breath, and dealing with that and the medical side, taking her to appointments, making sure that she took her medication on time. And as she got older, looking after her cleanliness, personal hygiene, that kind of thing. She goes on to say that her mum had a beautiful smile, and she passed away 1 month ago, and I miss her.
And it's not unusual to miss her. And this situation is not an unusual story, and it is a beautiful story that sometimes gets resolved before the death of the loved one. And here's an opportunity, too, that a lot of people don't always consider. When a person you know is going to die, and we all do die, I mean, we hope that it'll be after long years, a bunch of years of health and happiness, but sometimes people die at a young age because of accident or disease. When you know that the person is going to die, it's an opportunity to clean up your act, to resolve situations that should have been resolved before. It's also an opportunity for that individual who can talk in some form, either writing down or verbally, tell you from the questions that you ask about their life. What was it like growing up at the age of 10 years old in the country or the community where you were? When you went to high school, what was it like? Maybe they didn't even go to high school. You know, what was your first job? You know, when you got married, what was the most amazing part of living with grandma or mom or dad? You know, whatever those stories are. People at that time of life, when it's the end, they want to know that their life meant something. They want to know that their life had a purpose, that there was a mission, that they actually are going to be thought of after they're gone, that they leave a legacy. It's a good opportunity to ask them about their legacy, to let them know that you care about them, that they meant something to you, to move forward. And there's a difference between being the caretaker, being a child who isn't a caretaker when we're talking about parent-child, and also being a psychologist. You know, it's not that we're heartless by any means, but what we have to do as professionals is, even when we're helping care for the person for that session, we need to give them vehicles to use when they're not in the session, but also we have to learn how to compartmentalize those situations so we don't take those situations home with us. But there are situations that are quite devastating that even as psychologists, we can't just put them on a back burner or compartmentalize them until the next session, because they're pretty damaging, devastating. We're very concerned
about
that individual. Yeah. There's a difference. There's a difference. I was just going to say there's a difference between being a psychologist where you train to compartmentalize many of the cases. It doesn't mean you don't care about them when they're not there. You just learn to compartmentalize the emotions of it and be empathetic, not sympathetic. And being a caretaker where you actually are forced into being sympathetic rather than just empathetic. And this brings up a lot of belief issues, feeling issues, and therefore behavioral issues.
Well, I was going to come on to this in a little while. When we're looking at professional carers, which you are as a psychologist, you know, who cares for the carer? Who cares for the professional, for the doctor, the dentist, the nurse, the psychologist, the psychiatrist? Who do they go see when they need respite, when they need help, when they need guidance? So we'll come on to that in a little while, Dr. Raymond. But just to come back on this story and what you're saying, and I think you're right, and as she was echoing, she clearly got a lot out of the experience of caring for her mother in the last years of her life. Interesting that the brothers and sisters put the mother into a nursing home, and she was the one that took it on upon herself to take her out of the nursing home and care for her at her home. Those kinds of conversations are important, aren't they, between siblings? If you're looking at caring for elderly relative parents, at what point are you having the discussions about what's going to happen to mom or dad as they're now becoming infirm and not able to look after themselves, and sort of resigning over any conflict within the family when it comes to who's going to become the primary caregiver if they're not going to be in a home? And even if they're in a home, actually, you're still giving care going in as the child, adult child.
There's some societies today that allow us to be comfortable to put our family members in a nursing home or in a special facility. But there are also cultures that frown upon that, believing that it is our responsibility to take care of our parents who took care of us when we were younger. It's not an excuse, but it is an option. When you are unable to care for them because your own limitations, maybe you have physical limitations, maybe you have limitations that are economic, where you have to be working, you're responsible for a business, it may be in the best interest of the loved one to have them in a location where there is professional care that you can't provide because maybe they are suffering from a particular ailment, medical or psychological, that requires special care that it's difficult for you to do. So being able to help an individual by putting them in a location where you have that special care and doing that without guilt is a very important structure psychologically.
She says, even though mom was a hard person to look after, I still loved her with all my heart, mind and soul. And I suppose that, you know, she was true to herself. She did everything she could for her mom. For her, she can go on and live with that, you know, to know that she did the best for her mom, even though afterwards you're left thinking, where's my life? I put it on hold for some time. One of our listeners has texted in to say, I looked after a parent for a couple of years. He passed on. I felt a terrible void with all that time suddenly on my hands. And it took some time to develop a hobby, and I fortunately learned to fill that space.
And this is very characteristic of a good caretaker when they put their life on hold. Now, I deliberately said good caretaker because that's what society will say. You're a good son. You're a good partner. But the fact is, you could have been taking care of yourself then, possibly. Maybe you didn't want to. You know, because I've heard many, many people would say, I cannot go to my niece's wedding and leave my mother at home. What if she dies while I'm gone? They would feel guilty that they're not there. It's like they have to be there for the very last breath that their loved one takes. So they put their life on hold. Now, many times we'll say, look, stop being the martyr. Martyrs are dead. But it's not a matter of being a martyr. It's being a person who then allows the parent to have the same comfort that they were given by that parent when they were younger. I wish Naima was here to talk about development, human development, and how what goes around comes around. You know, in some of the holy books, it says from ashes to ashes, from dust to dust. It doesn't mean that literally. It means that when we're born, we have to be taken care of because as human beings, we're one of those animals in the human being that can't do everything for themselves in the first couple of years of life. There's somebody that has to actually do things for us. at the end of life, we may actually revert back to that same scenario where we can't do things for ourselves. So who should do that for us? And there's some people, there's some cultures that say it should be the same people for whom that person cared for.
Lots of messages coming in, sharing stories of caregiving and also people that have aware and conscious of what they've put people through their own illness, who have cared for them. Sharing your stories, taking your questions, what's making you anxious, what's keeping you awake at night, what's stressing you out, share it with us. And Dr. Raymond's here to help and offer guidance. He's a clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and clinics based at Jumeirah Lake Towers. Which building are you in, Dr. Raymond?
The Jumeirah Business Center 3. It's the first building when you enter from the Sariat Street on Dubai side, and it's the first cluster on the right. It's cluster Y, and it's a JBC 3. We're on the sixth floor. Great view, by the way.
I remember. It's amazing. Yeah, I've been to your place when I came to your opening there, when you moved into that new building. Yeah. Stunning views of the city.
It's just a lovely, lovely place. And some people say, you know, we're going to have a session with you just to come sit and look out the window, which is great. Everybody's welcome. You don't have to have a session. You're welcome just to come look out the window.
We are talking about, among many things this morning, but focusing to begin with on care, the carer, and who cares for the carer. Maybe they can be forgotten in amongst all the focus and attention going on the person that is ill, in need of care. And of course, illness can come in all different shapes and forms, whether it's mental illness, when you see somebody before your eyes change their behaviour. It might be gradual to begin with, but you start to see them perhaps become more withdrawn, more inward, mood swings, that kind of thing. And it could be that you become the person that identifies the need for professional help, and you might be the person that instigates that individual into a psychologist chair or a psychiatrist chair, and to get them on the road to recovery. It could be anything. It could be looking at taking care of an elderly parent and what that might entail, as we were talking about before. People are texting in with all sorts of examples. It's very interesting to see. One here: I had a dear friend whose husband had an affair in his late years. She and he worked together in their own business, but he was quite rude and mean to her in front of the staff. She, however, was the most pleasant person you'd ever meet. When he was diagnosed with cancer, high pressure and diabetes, and was hospitalised, she was the one who took her time and was with him till his death. Her devotion to him was just amazing, despite all his abuse to her. After his death, their business bloomed, her son's married, and she looks so much happier. Sometimes kindness is better revenge than being ill.
What goes around comes around.
Or being mean, sorry. They've just sent another text to correct the last word. Yes, so sometimes kindness is better revenge than being mean.
The person who takes on the more appropriate behavior is actually the person who's going to be the victor, simply because we all die, whether it's an illness or old age and we just die in our natural sleep, or it's because of some accident that happens. Whenever a person takes the choice of always being responsible, being mature, independent, flexible, adaptable, respectful of their role, regardless of how the other person behaves, they can live with themselves. The person who chooses to be rude and mean has to live with the guilt, with the fear of being neglected or abandoned, which can exacerbate diseases and disorders. The person may have taken advantage of a loving, caring partner who is always pleasant and devoted, but yet at some point, certainly that person must have realized where his life should have been different, because nobody sits on their bedside when they're dying or in their bed ready to die and say, you know what, I should have been much meaner to people, or I should have been in the office making more money than having time with my family. People don't do that. Towards the end, they usually realize what they should have done in life. Well, the person who takes the route of being independent and behaving appropriately regardless of what other people do, which is being responsible and respectful, also being adaptable and flexible, will live their life in a much more flavored way that is more component to joy and happiness. And yes, it is burdensome to take care of someone who's ailing, and especially when they're ailing in their behavior, not just in their illness. But then look at the reward. She can now live happily without the guilt of, I should have done something more. There's nothing more she could have done. Now, I don't know what her reward system is, and it doesn't matter, but she is a good model for that. And this is the kind of model that also can change other people's lives. So other people who observe this kind of behavior from this person who behaved in such a wonderful fashion can actually save the lives of others who she may not even know that she modeled for, because it may have actually transposed their life to want to be different and not wait until somebody's dying to be pleasant.
Very interesting. There's a story here from a gentleman called Philip, and it sort of encompasses what you've been saying from the beginning of the show, but it also makes you realize about the role that the partner can play in your illness. He's talking about depression and saying that he feels like the battle is almost over, his battle with depression. He touches on, as you did earlier, nestling in your mother's arms as a child. You have no idea what's to come in your life. And when you're growing up and you're seeing brothers and sisters flourish and they're well balanced and they're doing well, and you somehow are struggling internally, but maybe not consciously, but when you look back, you can see that. And he asks, who needs help? What's wrong with me? Is there anything wrong? There can't be anything wrong with me. He says, I'm male, I'm 6 feet tall, and I'm full of muscle. That's what I have to be. I have to be strong, and that's what people expect of me. He goes on to say, but now married and 2 children in tow, I sat one day near a stream and I said, I'm tired. My brain is bruised. It feels like I cannot go on anymore. Just leave me here. Just you go on. And he's saying this to his wife. And his wife says, well, she refused. And she sat by my side as if we'd just married that morning. And she says, come on, Phil, you have to get up. You need some help. And she took me to the doctor, and I sat in that doctor's surgery and began another journey in my life, highs and lows, but she was with me every single step of the way. And I feel now this battle is almost over. So acknowledging the role his wife took in getting him to heal, to get well, and to get him on the right path in his life.
And it's great that he didn't have to die to realize that he could have celebrated life. So here he was celebrating life before his death, and it gives life a better meaning, a more nourishing meaning. And it has nothing to do with how much money you have, what size house you're living in. It has to do with the bonding you have with your fellow human beings and especially your loved ones.
Imagine if that person, that wife, had walked away, turned away at that point. And she may have good reason, because this is what we're getting at, is everybody is different and everyone has, you know, strengths and weaknesses, and some people are able better to step up and respond to somebody that's ailing and failing, when others feel, I can't do that, I can't cope with it, I can't deal with it, and so they need that support as well. He says, you cannot go on a journey alone. You need a shoulder to cry on. You need someone to listen to you and to talk to you. It's like good food and a nice warm bed on those freezing cold nights. You may need medication, but you need somebody that's able to wrap you up and give you the support you'll need. So who supports the carer, Dr. Raymond, and what kind of support do carers need?
Well, carers need to be acknowledged for what they do, and they need to be appreciated. And this is one of the things that people sometimes forget. We make assumptions that they're doing this because they love it and they don't need to be rewarded for it. However, we don't want to look at the caretaker and take them for granted. Self-care for the caretaker is very important. And here is where we help the person understand that guilt is a normal process, and that it's an opportunity for challenge, or for change, rather, in the relationship. And I'm not sure why I unconsciously said challenged before I said change, but that's probably why I'm a psychologist, too. So I'll have to figure that one out with my peer review. But the guilt is a normal process, and we shouldn't have to feel guilty about feeling guilty. So here, we want to look at what changes can we possibly make. Are we overdoing it? Do we find ourselves sacrificing? And when we start to sacrifice, what is it that we accept and we expect from others? So what we accept may be a lot less than what we think we deserve. And that's when you get some of the behaviors that can be quite destructive. And then it gets more amplified and it gets into a cyclical process.
So do you also, would you mean like the caretaker might need to maybe, they're doing things to help them get through the caring? So whether they are turning to alcohol or whether they're turning to more food or they're turning to, or they need medication themselves to help them stay, in their mind, stay strong and be able to be there for the person that's sick.
When sometimes all they need to do is take a break. You know, it's just like a great mom knows that she can only take so much. Being the perfect mom doesn't mean you're there 24/7 without a minute away. It's good for moms to take off 15 minutes if she possibly can, or at least 5 minutes every hour or two. Just go out in the yard. Back in the old days, they used to say mom should go in the backyard and scream, you know, for about 3 to 5 minutes. You know, the kids aren't going to die. Don't worry. They're going to be fine in the house. You'll go back and you'll find them, even if they are crying because they didn't know why you were screaming. You might need to have just that relief. Or sometimes in addition to that, every few hours, having 5 or 10 minutes away by going out in the yard and sitting, reading a book, closing your eyes, whatever you want to do, maybe a half a day a week, you should also go and pamper yourself. Do some of those things that people do. Go to have a manicure, pedicure, massage, whatever it is. Or plan on a breakfast morning or a lunch with your friends once a week. You know, this is something you can do and not feel guilty about. It's very important because you come back more nourished, more refreshed. Also, realizing the difference between being a helper and being responsible, because there are limitations. You can't be responsible for a person's life. You can't be responsible for how they think, feel, or behave. Now, you can take responsibility to help them improve their quality of life, but you can't make them have that quality of life if they're rejecting it. Just if they reject it doesn't mean you turn around and walk out. You can still help. You can still help by being consistent in your caretaking. Also, make a plan. It's very important that you do have plans where there are times to do other activities, and also make sure that another sibling or whoever it is that substitutes for your work can come in. Make sure you have vacation time. You know, back in the days of my psychoanalytic training, they used to teach us you work 7 weeks and take one full week off. Instead of, I'll wait for the summer to accumulate those 6 weeks or 4 weeks or 2 weeks, every 7 weeks there should be 1 week off. Well, today what we're learning, which is a different generation that we're dealing with, that time off needs to be much more frequent. You know, and what we're teaching in the balance for life on a daily basis is every single day, whether it's morning for 30 minutes, afternoon for 30 minutes, getting home and spending time with family, you need to have time on a daily basis where you do recreate, nothing to do with the stresses of work.
Dr. Raymond, a message here. My sister-in-law is battling stage 4 cancer in the UK. We're so far away and really want to help our brother who is devastated and their children. What can we do from here?
You always stay in touch. Telephone calls, Skyping, visiting. You can send gifts, not out of guilt, but just things that they might need. You might even help out financially with things like that that might be going on. But the constant telephone calling, the reassuring that you're there for anything that they need. Make it a point to go visit. Even go there deliberately to get the brother out of the house for a while you substitute caretaking for your sister-in-law. You know, these are things that you can do on a regular basis, even though there may be nothing you can do anymore about the cancer when it's fourth stage. You can do something about improving the quality of life for the whole family. And that means that what you're going to do is help relieve them of the pressure, let them know that there's somebody to talk to. Let them repeat the same fears and concerns and sorrowful statements over and over and over again rather than trying to stop them. If they want to cry, let them cry. Let them have those normal emotions. Let them go through the denial, the bargaining, the anger. Let them know that it's okay to be depressed because you're feeling the depression with them. They'll get to the acceptance a lot quicker. Getting closure on that is much quicker when there's family support.
Mm. And so although we're divided geographically, you don't have to be divided in your feeling and thought and presence. via that phone call. And as you said before, when somebody, if you're on the periphery watching somebody caring for someone else and the support they need, is sometimes they just need to know that you know that they're doing the best they can. It needs to be acknowledged. So
of course,
that phone call, whether it's, you know, every few days or once a week, or maybe it's a conversation.
Skype every day.
Yeah, if that's what they want, I suppose, is the other thing.
Well, yeah, of course. I'm not trying to impose anything on anybody. But sometimes Skyping is very helpful because, you know, even though the person may be dying of cancer and you realize there could be some changes in body configuration, they still want people to look at them, to acknowledge them, to tell them how they're feeling about their illness, and they wish they could be there to help, or we are going to go visit with you. Is that okay? When would you like for us to come? We'd like to stay with you for a while. And here's a chance, depending on the age of the individual and their mental state, the kind of things that you would involve them in. You know, get them in the car, take them for a drive. You know, let them see what the city looks like. You know, and don't talk about you're going to die and what do you want to wear, you know, in your casket. You can talk about the new building that's going up. Now, interestingly, I said you don't have to talk about those things, but at some point you do need to. And the person who's dying wants to talk about that. They want to tell you what they want to wear. They want to tell you what kind of service they want to have. They want to tell you how to deal with the children, how they want the children to have to deal with their death, and how they want to intervene with the children in the death process. So this is a very, very important time to not end life, but to get closure on it. So the celebration of that person's life will live for a long time.
Mm, and it has meaning for all of us at some point. It's an, you know, and we don't want to think about it or talk about it. But
we never like to, do we? It's the only thing we're guaranteed.
Well, but also for the people that we love, if that's going to happen, if we're going to see a loved one get sick and be there for them, and it's, you know, it, you can feel that knot in the stomach, and you don't want to be selfish about it and just be when that person's sick. But the reality is we're all human beings. So the fear factor of what's expected of us and making the first step, whether it be the phone call or whether it be getting on a plane and going to see that person, you have to do it. But how? But some people don't, Dr. Raymond. And so if somebody's teetering on that, I'm not suggesting these people have texted in, but if you're teetering on the, actually in some ways, when we talk about it's hard being an expatriate and being away from your loved ones at home, but in some cases, it lets us off the hook, doesn't it? It means we can use that as a reason why we don't have to be in touch as much or we don't need to do as much. And if we're in that situation, what would your advice be to pick up that phone to make, because we're scared, if it's just about being scared at what you're going to be faced with and what's going to be expected of you?
You don't have to wait to experience the death of a loved one to appreciate why it's important for people to call. You need to make that call. It is so important to do that. You'd be surprised how people who are suffering the death of a loved one or the dying process of a loved one appreciate and will remember your telephone call. It's difficult for us to think about calling because what do we say? Whether the person's dying or they're already dead, what do we say to their loved ones? It's one of the things that scares us because what if we don't know what to say? You know, sometimes people think, well, we're supposed to be sad. We're supposed to look sad. We're supposed to be tearful. Well, you don't have to be. Sometimes, you know, you can just say, you know, I'm really sorry I'm having to call you about this occasion. Hopefully the next time we talk, it'll be a happier occasion. But frankly, I'm sure you have a lot of great memories about this loved one.
Mm. And if they're sick and it's about, you know, doing something to help somebody that's sick, it's a similar thing in that don't wait, overcome that fear and kind of get stuck in, I suppose. And mistakes may be made and emotions are going to be raw and there may be tears. And it's, you know, we could say, I don't want to go into that emotion. That's, I know it's going to be a sad time. Even if it's somebody that's not dying, they're just sick. It's still about a lot of things you're going to see and hear that you've never seen or heard before. And you've got to go into it.
And it's okay to cry. That's one of the things that people are afraid of. What if I start crying when I'm talking to them? Well, you know what? What a beautiful expression that is, to actually be able to cry, to let them know that you're so involved with what they may be going through. They really appreciate that, that they're not the only ones, that you're not just calling because it's an obligation. You're calling them because it's heartfelt. And people need to hear that. And you're doing them a service by letting them know that there is human connection here, that the loved one who is ailing or is dying or is already dead had a purpose that's meaning for the, for you, and you're appreciating that through calling the loved ones who are having to survive the loss of a loved one. You know, and sometimes we think there must be something that couldn't be worse. There must be nothing worse than losing a child. When you're a grown parent and your child who's already an adult dies, there might be nothing worse than that. But that's especially when you want to call and you want to cry with them. You want to hold their hand over the telephone, so to speak. Let them know that there's that emotional connection, that there's that human concern. That actually lives for a long time. And for those of us that have experienced the death of a loved one, we actually remember the people who called, when they called, and what was said. So it's a very important opportunity for you to realize that it's not dreadful, you're not going to cause any more pain, but you're actually helping that individual. And what goes around comes around, because one day you'll need those telephone calls yourself.
And again, if it's about somebody being sick and it's not life-threatening and they're going to move through this illness and recover, what role did you play in taking care of them and taking responsibility for them? Dr. Raymond Hamdan's here, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Thank you to those of you that have texted in with such kind words. It's our absolute pleasure to serve you here on Dubai Today, taking your questions and helping where and when we can. And also sometimes just sharing ideas, your thoughts, no right or wrong to it. It's just about exploring the world as we know it, as we see it as individuals. I'm going to get back on topic about carers and caretaking and some really lovely and emotional stories coming in about your experiences as caretakers looking after loved ones when they are sick. But I want to come back on a message that came in a little bit earlier regarding somebody whose niece, who's 20 years of age, and she was a very healthy child, but for the last 5 years has become anorexic. She lost 20 kg and now is 25 kg. She doesn't eat and she fights back if we tell her to eat. She says she's fine. She's active but continues to lose weight. We fear for her.
This is a very concerning situation. Anorexia is a very dangerous disorder because if it goes for too long, there's an enzyme that changes, and please don't ask me what that enzyme is, I can't remember, but it makes it difficult forever to be a reverse. As a matter of fact, medicine may get to the point where medicine cannot even reverse the problem, and the person is definitely going to be on a dying track. Now, this is not to scare you unduly, it's just to warn you that this is not something that can be taken care of at home. This person has to be maybe forced into a proper place where there's treatment for anorexia, and there's various places around the world, not any here that I know of, that handles eating disorders, but it's a very, very serious disorder. And even if it's at the beginning, you still have to take it seriously. Don't wait till it's too late. Unfortunately, with anorexia, it can be too late when it goes on for several years. The person is not able to determine for themselves what they need or what they don't need because they have a distortion in their own body image. Even when they are just skin and bones, they see themselves as overweight. They will lie about what they're not eating. They will lie about how they're dispelling of food, whether it's suppository or forced throwing up. They go through an entire process of power struggle, so that's not unusual to hear that when an anorexic is told to eat, they become combative. And this is where it may be, some analysts would say, an unconscious suicide attempt. But regardless of what that is, I need to put you in the picture very, very clearly. You don't keep the person at home. You don't try to deal with it day to day. This does require immediate intervention, and it's very strict intervention that could mean a resort facility that's a health resort. And I'm using the word resort because it's not always a typical hospital setting where they specialize in these. And the person may need to be there for 6 weeks or 2 months, but this is exactly what's required. And you need to find out where these locations are. You can call professionals like clinical psychologists, psychiatrists who specialize in this, social workers, or competent licensed people who do know where these facilities are, and they will be able to guide you in the right direction. But you have to act now. This is not something that you say, well, let's talk about it next week when I see them again. You don't want to waste time.
So the first thing to do if you're not sure is to contact a professional like yourself or a doctor to find out where this person could go. in the interim, Dr. Raymond, you know, intervention, if we're in a place where there isn't a facility close by, as we're saying, there isn't a facility here in the UAE.
Not that I'm aware of.
But this person, if somebody's in critical situation, could they be hospitalized here until they you're able to move them to a specialist facility?
There is hospitalization opportunities. However, I'm not sure that the professionals are available to deal with it, because this is not a situation you just put the person in the hospital and the physician comes around every 24 hours for 5 minutes, say, hey, how you doing, and then charges an enormous rate just for that 5 second visit. Nor is there a facility where, even if you do have qualified psychologists who specialize in eating disorders, and not just any psychologist, psychiatrist, or social worker can do this, you have to be specialized in this treatment modality. So it is a very specialty kind of a process, and not everybody is available for that or is even existing here. I don't know who would be specializing in this. In either case, it's a milieu that has to also be available, not just the person that you visit once a week or twice a week. This has to be an entire environment that is a treatment facility. And there are those that I'm aware of in the United Kingdom, other places in Europe, United States, Thailand. There's many other places around the world that have these facilities. Capio Hospital, that was actually a hospital started by Florence Nightingale in London, has a facility, but it is a downtown hospital. There's places like Meadows, which is a health resort in Arizona. There are places that specialize in addiction in Thailand that we work with. So, and I'm not using these to advertise by any means. I'm just giving you an example that they do exist, and you need to act fast on this so you can get the help. Mm. It is expensive, but are you going to worry about the money and saving the life of a relative, a family member? Or what's more important to you? Help needs to be gotten, and this is nothing that can be dealt with on just a few hours a week as outpatient.
But do you need any kind of referral? For example, if you are just looking at your daughter or son and thinking that's what they need, and you connect with a facility overseas and then you get on a plane and you go there, but before that, here on the ground here, is there some form of assessment to know that when you enter that facility, you're entering the right one and for the right reasons?
Yes, as a matter of fact, when we are involved in these cases, we are the ones that will do the initial interview and assessment. But then a second assessment is done upon arrival at the facility. And that's always important. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with us or anybody else. It's always good to get a second opinion, because in these situations, the person may present one way in one facility, and then other information may come out when they're at a different time in a different place. I remember one time I've had cases that were quite interesting cases. It was a person who actually behaved quite bizarrely at times, but never was told to the physician at the other location before they came to us what was really going on. When they came to us, we found out information that they hadn't shared before. So we knew more about the diagnostic. That doesn't mean we were better than the other facility. It's just that they gave us information they had not given the other facility. And this is something that doesn't mean superiority. You don't do any power plays. And if you find that your specialist that you're going to feels superior because they know more information, go to somebody else. This is not a power play game. This is serious. We are physicians. We are psychologists. We are specialists that are trained to help people find the right information to make the correct diagnosis. It's not competition who does it better. But you have to remember, we're not mind readers. We only know what you tell us. Now, some things we can not guess at, but we can put two and two together when you give us a couple of different symptoms. We say, okay, maybe there's something else going on that you're not telling us, so we can investigate that. But if you deny it, we're not going to go out and investigate whether you're lying or not. So the more truthful you are, the more open you are. And this is why we involve families many times in the first interview sessions. We want to know, are there things that this person is not telling us? And of course, we have to do that with permission. So it is important that you do have an assessment. And yes, there are qualified people here that can do the assessments to make the proper referral. And then a reassessment is done upon arrival at the new referral.
Text message here, Dr. Raymond. I have in my family a person who has all the symptoms of the narcissist borderline personality as described before. It's so bad that everyone sees it, knows it, must be treated, but nobody can get that help due to the person's refusal to get help. They're aggressive towards us. How can we help such a person get the treatment they need, especially when they're refusing to accept any help?
Again, this is a situation where a person may not have any choice, because in a borderline personality disorder, it's an emotional instability, and the emotional intensity is very, very high. There are 10 personality disorder type. They come in different clusters. And this one is also clustered with narcissism, a narcissistic personality disorder, and histrionic personality disorder. With the borderline personality disorder, there's impulsivity, there's the instability of the emotions, interpersonal relationships are really bad, self-image is bad, there's a fear of abandonment. So many times what they do is they make a person's life miserable just to feel connected. So they would rather have the bad connection than to have no connection at all. There's a lot of intense anger. There's a lot of irritability. Even if you can finally get a divorce from this person who refuses help, they're not going to let you go. They'll get the shirt off your back, and then they want more. You know, it's a very, very devastating kind of a personality to deal with. As a matter of fact, these are the kind of persons that can also, personality-wise, make you crazy. As a matter of fact, when Masters and Masters wrote the first book that was about 3 inches thick on borderline personality disorders, and this was back in the early 70s. Matter of fact, they were professors of mine in my postdoctoral studies in psychoanalysis. And it was amazing to listen to them talk about the books that they've been writing on this and teaching us about it when personality and various disorders didn't have the same meaning as it did today. So at the time, we weren't sure if a borderline personality disorder was somewhat psychotic or somewhat anxious. And back then, it used to be called neurotic. So in this borderline personality disorder, they can be very, very draining, which is different than the narcissistic. The narcissistic isn't only different in the fact that with a narcissistic personality disorder, there can actually be a dangerous factor to this. There's an excessive preoccupation with power, prestige, vanity, even to the point where they could get involved in murdering just to have the attention that they want. They're so egocentric, megamaniac. You know, it's very, very dangerous kind of a splitting behavior of the personality. So these situations are dangerous. I've gone through an extensive process of not elaborating, but giving you a quick synopsis of what each one is.
And some of the worst-case scenarios.
Well, of course, I'm going to give you the worst-case scenario because I don't know what your situation is. I'll give you the textbook.
Yeah.
You know, but the textbook needs to be taken seriously because at least it tells you there's nothing that you can do about it. Here's a situation where it fools people because, like with the borderline, if there's company over, they are just the life of the party. They're brilliant. Up to a certain time, different than the histrionic personality disorder, who can act for hours on end or days on end when there's company, the borderline can't. That you can only go for a couple of hours, and then you start seeing different colors. And then when people are gone, it's like a dark cloud of hell comes over that home, and everybody's scared again of what that parent may do or what that sibling may do who suffers from this kind of a personality disorder. These are situations where treatment has to be forced. And many times what you need to do is you need to group together as a family and people that may be friends with this individual if they do have friends. And together you need to address the issues that you're concerned about with them, with people where they won't act out. So that way they're more likely to try to comply, at least verbalize they're going to comply, knowing when everybody leaves it's going to be hell again. But at least they know that they need to get help, and you're going to insist on it. Now, they're going to resist. Of course, they're going to try to persuade the psychiatrist or psychologist that there's nothing wrong. And even when the psychiatrist or clinical psychologist tells them, you have a problem that needs to be addressed, what they're going to do is they're going to go home and say, see, the doctor said if you would treat me nicely, everything would be okay. I wouldn't have these problems. Complete denial, complete manipulation. Unfortunately, these kind of situations very, very seldom outlive a relationship. They're usually going to have a breakup, and that breakup is going to be devastating for everybody because they'll never really let go.
It's always interesting to hear, and of course one hopes it's not going to happen to you, and we clearly see that as life is and as it plays out, and from our listeners interacting with the show, that sometimes it, you know, illness, mental health issues fall at your door, or even for you yourself individually, you may start to feel sick. And just hearing there about the narcissistic personality, and just to understand what it is, and to understand what it might be like for somebody that is suffering from it. And I picked up this story, and it's in connection to our opening topic today, which is about caring for another and who supports the carer. And sometimes the person being cared for may not want to acknowledge what somebody has done for them. And maybe they're not able to acknowledge it because they're so sick. But this person does acknowledge it. And in so doing, telling their story, you get an insight into what it might be like if you suffer from bipolar. Let me share some of it with you, if I may. Bear with me. It's a long story, but I will give you the abridged version of it. And it's called The Inner Journey, Learning to Live with Bipolar by Jamie Beggs. He says, I was having a great time away. And actually, Jamie's a girl. It's a girl. I was having a great time away and was glad that I'd achieved my dream of travelling the world. I was in Spain, and as a result of speaking a lot of in Spanish, I was noticing that I was feeling quite tired mentally. I'd also noticed over the time that I'd spent at the festival that my thought processes had sped up from time to time. I remember as I was talking to Neil that I felt like getting away and that relaxing for a few days in San Sebastian would be a good idea. After talking to Neil, I decided we were going to head up to this place where a number of other people were that were enjoying themselves at the festival. And as we were walking through the streets, I recall feeling quite faint. I was having a general conversation with Neil about our trip and what we were planning on doing in the future. And as I was talking, I once again noticed that my thought processes had begun to speed up. I explained to Neil that something was happening to me and that I would need to sit down. Neil said he would get me a glass of water from one of the bars along the street, and I waited on a small fence on the side of the road. I continued to feel lightheaded, and Neil came back with a glass of water, and I had a sip of the water, and I tried to get my thoughts together. After 5 minutes or so, I got off the fence and once again felt faint. The next thing that occurred to me, or what happened to me, was that my legs buckled under me and I collapsed, falling to the ground. I think I blacked out briefly, but found that upon regaining consciousness, my thoughts were still racing. My thoughts were not unlike a tape recorder being sped up. By this time, Neil had run off to call an ambulance, and I remember finding it hard to gain control of my thoughts as I was beginning to panic, wondering what was happening to me. Now, this situation continued for this girl, Jamie, and her partner continued to help her. She ended up going to hospital and being hospitalised. And throughout all of this, Neil stayed by her side and was trying to keep her calm. There was even an incident where she was able to run away, and he chased after her and got to her and found her and was able to calm her and calm her down until he could get her back into a facility. It's been described as a psychotic episode, which then went on to be diagnosed as bipolar. And for me, I've heard, and we've talked before about bipolar, doctor, but you know, that the idea of when somebody's going through it and not knowing what's happening to them, and for the person that's with you, that loves you, not understanding why your behavior's changing and what could be happening and how they can help that person.
I've never had an experience, even in my professional life or personal life, when a person was starting a bipolar. Usually I've seen them when they're already bipolar. And there's two types of bipolar. There's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, which is cleverly to call it two types. I didn't make that up. Bipolar affective disorder is a term that used to be used. Manic depression is still one that people still famously use And that's actually what we're talking about when we talk about bipolar. Bipolar 1 is when the standard textbook symptoms, the very, very high highs with the mania, feeling total elation, their brain is going hundreds of miles a minute, there is a flight of ideas, they can be quite aggressive. And then for the same period of time that they're having that manic state, they may have the depression state. And it could be for 3 days, 3 weeks, or 3 months, and then they go through depression for 3 days, 3 weeks, or 3 months, whatever the balance is between the two levels. Bipolar 2 is when the mania is actually hypomania. It's below the hypermania. So there is agitation, there is flight of ideas, but it's not where the person cannot function. They can still be ambulatory. They can still hold down a job. They can still respond to family. But there's still a lot of that agitation kind of process. And this is where we see exaggerated mood swings. The bipolar 1 is definitely a clinical expression. There's no question what it is. But unfortunately, what's happening today in medicine, and especially for physicians who are not psychiatry, trained or oriented, anything that's a mood swing, they just seem to freely call it bipolar. And all of a sudden, people are getting on these medications that they don't need, making things even worse. Now, earlier you mentioned a psychotic episode. Usually, acute psychotic episode can be because of a chemical imbalance that could even be because of extensive symptoms of burnout.
When we come back, we'll hear more from Dr. Raymond about bipolar, understand it better, and also for the partner, for the loved one that is with that person with bipolar, what can they do to help and what support do they need to help somebody who's suffering from bipolar? Stay with us. Yes, Dr. Raymond Handon, clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. We'll be giving out Dr. Raymond's contact details. We've been looking at the role of the carer, caring for the loved one that's sick, maybe terminally ill, maybe has a mental illness, it could be an elderly relative, or different ways that you can care for somebody else when they are going through a rough patch. And who cares for you? Who cares for the carer? What support is out there? What support is needed? And not to underestimate what they may be going through in caring for another person. And even in some cases, it can lead to that person becoming sick as well. So it's important to be vigilant and to look out for each other. We were just sharing a story there about Jamie, a lady who was really articulating the first sort of awareness, if you like, of going into bipolar and having bipolar. And Dr. Raymond was explaining what bipolar is, type 1 and type 2, and to understand better this psychotic episode and what that means, Dr. Raymond.
Many times people can have what's called an acute psychotic episode. That means that the onset is sudden, which is different than a chronic psychotic episode. Chronic psychotic episode means that it's been going on a long time. It doesn't stop. Psychosis could be schizophrenia, paranoid states. It could be manic depression or bipolar or other states where a person is completely confused, out of touch with reality. And some of these will also include hallucinations, delusions. With the bipolar scenario, what was described by this person who very, very eloquently walked us through what was being experienced is an acute psychotic disorder. And this means that they're out of touch with reality. But interestingly, even though it is a chemical imbalance, it can be induced by extreme stress. When it goes beyond stress, it becomes burnout. And the most extreme cases of burnout can involve what now we call acute psychotic episode. This is where hospitalization is needed. As a matter of fact, regardless of what the person wants or thinks that they want, you have to be the caretaker, no matter who you are, and get them to a hospital. They must be hospitalized through the emergency room where they are assessed, diagnosed, put with a psychiatrist who will give the right medication to calm them down, observe them for at least 2 or 3 days, and make sure that the medication that's going to be given to them is the correct medication for their type of psychotic episode, because sometimes there's a thin line between what looks to be schizophrenia and what looks to be the manic part of bipolar. As a matter of fact, at one time, there used to be a breakdown of fourth stage mania that looked very much like paranoid schizophrenia. The difference was how they responded to the medication. So if the medication that was given was for schizophrenia and they didn't respond, that was a pretty good indication that it's a bipolar disorder and vice versa. So what happens then is that the medication needs to be given because it is a chemical imbalance causing psychotic thinking. The psychotic thinking, even with hypomania, can involve rapid speech, uninterrupted mannerisms, racing thoughts, hypersexuality, dealing with many, many topics all at once, unable to sleep at night. And then we know now with sleep deprivation that can even exacerbate that even more. There's going to be psychomotor problems, appetite changes, increase in anxieties, sometimes delusions, hallucinations. With the bipolar, there's usually a higher risk of suicide. So here, the only choice you have, get them into a hospital. And the hospital has got to be a government hospital, for instance, that has a psychiatric division. That's the only solution. There's no such thing, well, let's wait it out. Now, sometimes when a person is hypomanic, they may show signs that look softer than the mania. However, here you still have to be cautious because you have to determine whether their symptoms are because of sleep deprivation, because of a work schedule that could contribute to that, or if they are actually having delusions, hallucinations, if that might apply, and not always does it apply. You need to also look at hospitalization for that person quite immediately. Sometimes people try to wait, it's too late, you got to get them into the hospital. So when asking what to do, get them into a hospital. That's the safest solution.
Just hearing some of those symptoms and behaviours, that's going to put a lot of pressure and strain on a relationship, on the people around that person, and so coping with that and dealing with that. And you outlined earlier some tips and tools to help. If you are a carer, make sure you get time out, make sure you take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. It's okay to ask for help or even ask for professional help, and to just make sure that you're eating well and that you're getting the sleep. Because how often can you see, say for example with mental illness, Dr. Raymond, if you're looking at certain kinds of mental illness where the carer can also start to show signs of getting ill too, maybe some forms of depression, for example, where the carer starts to become depressed also?
Yeah, forgive my French accent, which is not good. It's sometimes it's called folie à deux, which means that you pick up the frailties of the partner. And sometimes your partner might be the patient. So we see this usually with older couples, one who is starting to show signs of dementia, then the non-demented patient, the non-demented partner will start showing the same signs. And that's the folie à deux, which means that they pick up the symptoms of the sick person. But then that same terminology can apply to caregivers as well, in which many times we get so involved with caring for that person and we have no other frame of reference in our life that becomes the frame of reference. Mm. So we find ourselves getting tired, getting into a situation where we're not thinking clearly, and we may not even see it ourselves. It might be seen by others who visit with us, who call us, who realize that we're not calling them. It could be many different things that happens. When we tend to be professionals working with these cases, we need to actually take a break from it. So just as there is a difference between what's the usual kind of mood swings during the day and what could be the manic depression or bipolar, there's also in between that something that's called cyclothymic, that's more of an exaggerated mood swing that can be seen, for instance, with the borderline cases, narcissistic cases. There's also the same thing with dealing with people and how we react to it, how we respond to it. When we're finding ourselves unable to effectively do our work, ineffectively do recreation, we're finding ourselves tired, sleepy, or we can't sleep, these are pretty good signs that you're going through some unhealthy depression that and needs to be addressed.
And it's a stress, isn't it? It's when you're living under stress and distress that your body can react in different ways, and even physically. Signs where you might get issues with the skin, you may be prone to put weight on or lose weight. There's lots of ways that, or headaches, as you said, sleep deprivation, all these can be signs that you're not coping as well because you're under stress and because it's a lot to deal with, so you need to take care of you.
Yeah, denial is one of the biggest problems that everybody has, and at first we don't want to admit that we have a problem. And even as professionals, we can get exhausted seeing patients, for instance, hour after hour. And it's not fair, it's not fair to the patient if we don't acknowledge it. And we keep working and we're not at our best. So this is where peer review comes in, very helpful. And we can go over this with our colleagues. We may have somebody special who we bounce things off once a week, once a day, or once a month, whatever the cases are that you're having. So in these situations, what we're able to do is we're able to do a peer review, which means that we're able to go over not only the cases and discuss patient situations, but we're also going over our reaction to these. It's called countertransference. So we don't deal just with the transference of the patient to us. We deal with our countertransference, which means how we feel about the patient and how it's affecting us. So whether we're psychologists, psychiatrists, or social workers who are professionally doing this, or whether we're caretakers who are family members, there needs to be a check-in point on a daily basis or weekly basis with people who know us, who care about us, and mutually in reverse. And we can trust them to tell us, you're really starting to get strung out. We really need you to get out of here for a while, or we need to get help for you. Once you're past that denial, then you're going to be much, much faster in recovering from whatever you didn't even know was causing you problems.
So let's go back to the text messages. And one here saying that my sister-in-law in the US has psychiatric problems, sometimes up, sometimes down. My brother takes care of her and three children. He's out of a job. He's been out of a job for 7 months and he's frustrated. We talk to him regularly, but what else can we do to help? They're so very far away. And also, what way can I talk to my sister-in-law, because she does not like to talk to us, and also one of their sons has autism.
Well, there seems to be a lot of complexities going on, and this can be quite draining. And many times what people do when they're overwhelmed is they distance themselves. Not intentionally, but that might be the only thing that they can do, because there's no time to do anything else, like intervene, interject, take suggestions from others. Even if the person doesn't want to talk on the telephone or refuses to, send a letter. If they read their emails, send an email. Usually letters are pretty good because it's a hard piece of material. When they get it, they can't resist but to open it up. With an email, you can just delete it and pretend you never received it. So when these situations come up and you do want to be available, find a way to communicate with the person just simply by saying, we're concerned about you, we want to help you, please let us know what we can do to help. You don't have to make suggestions. You don't have to impose on them, because they may not be ready to understand that it's trying to be helpful. They might see it as just another burden that they have to think about and do something about, and they don't have time for that. So by just sending a short, sweet, complete note, we care about you, we're wanting to know what's going on, what can we do to help? That's it. That would be the best thing to do to start off with.
Another message here saying, I lost my sister to a tragic accident 10 years ago, and now that I have a child, I can't seem to stop worrying all the time about my child and other family members also tragically dying.
It's a difficult thing to get over, isn't it? Once you've had a tragic episode like that, a tragic situation, it always stays somewhere in your mind, what if it happens to other people who I care about? The problem with tragedy is that not only is it the loss of the person, it happens unexpectedly. And usually tragedies are unusual human events. And frankly, a car accident is an unusual human event, no matter how frequent it may be. Statistically, they might say, well, it's usual. But that's a statistical number. But emotionally, it's a tragedy. It's unusual. People aren't supposed to die in a car accident. People are not even supposed to have car accidents, nor airplane accidents or anything else. Frankly, people aren't even supposed to die of diseases when it comes to the psychology. We're supposed to die when we're old and run out of psychological or physical fuel. But those things don't happen. These are the kind of things that will not haunt us necessarily, but they do stay in our mind. When it stays in your mind to the point where you cannot think about anything else, you obsess, you have difficulty sleeping because of it, you have heart palpitations, erratic breathing when you think about it, your child is out with a relative, all you're thinking about is, are they going to be okay? Are they going to be in an accident? Am I going to get a bad telephone call? That's when you need to get help for anxiety. And these kind of anxieties that result into the phobias or generalized anxieties can be treated. It doesn't mean that you're not going to worry, but at least you worry within a reasonable frame of thinking and not an exaggerated irrational, illogical level of thinking.
And if you're carrying that kind of anxiety, how easy is it to then be passed on to others in the family or around you?
A lot of children actually pick up the same symptoms that are displayed by the parents. So sometimes when we treat the parents, we actually cure the child.
We were talking about caring, and from the professional point of view, who cares for the carer? You know, doctors, dentists, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists. For you, Dr. Raymond, if you are in need, who do you turn to? And professionally, what does that entail? Is there a sort of guideline within the profession of psychology?
Well, it's not required as far as legally you have to do that. But it certainly is highly recommended, and it also borders on an ethical principle that you need to be in pretty good shape to work with people. So you yourself to be in good shape means that you may need to have assistance from time to time. It's also good to do this on a preventive measure. So what we do, for instance, in our practice is we have peer review, and whether it's once a week when we get together as a group and we may discuss a particular case without giving names, but we would discuss not only the symptoms of the case to make sure it's correctly diagnosed and we're treating it well, we're also looking at how we're reacting to it. So we do that as a group. There's also the option that whenever one of us needs the other, we can call on them anytime. There's also a couple of people that have started a monthly gathering of psychologists and psychiatrists, and we do get together once a month. We actually have a case that someone will present, and that becomes the discussion for that evening. And all of us can chime in, all of us can have been in, and we all learn from each other. You know, even though we have our doctorate degrees, most of us, we always are still learning. It's called a practice because we continue practicing. There's always something new. There's always something different. There's things that we continue to benefit from one case to benefit the other. So it's a growing process. As a matter of fact, the things that I learned to do by 1977, when I was awarded my doctorate's degree, I'm probably not even using 20% of that, because all the stuff that now is happening, 80% of it is brand new stuff. So every year, we're learning more and more techniques, things to do, and we need to stay on top of that. And part of that is learning about ourselves. So sometimes some of us also have colleagues that we've known for many, many years. Maybe they were our professors. Maybe they were fellow students. And we still stay in touch with each other. And whether it's once a week or once every month or whenever we need, we have a person we can call up and say, hey, I've got a situation going on here. Here's what's going on with it. Help me work this out. I want to know if I'm thinking rationally on this. Am I developing some thoughts on this that might be me that I need to keep out of this? Or are there other things that I'm not finding that need to be discovered? So we do this peer review process.
And as a practitioner, is there any requirement or guideline or criteria when it comes to the amount of time that you practice? Are you requested to take breaks at certain times? Because if you are dealing with people that are ill and all you're doing is working with clients, with patients, at some point, your judgment and your physical well-being
may become scarred, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no written law that says you have to do it a particular way. It's usually left up to you as an individual to be fair and be fair to your patients as well as to yourself, and to also seek peer review on this. So sometimes that's part of the peer review. It says, hey, listen, you really need to take a break. You're really looking exhausted. It doesn't sound like you're having time to think through things fairly, logically, and at the kind of level that we know that you're capable of. Just as we do that for students, we have a supervision time. Sometimes we need that for ourselves, even when we are the supervisors. So even though there's no law that governs this, there's an ethical code that says we may need to do that and we should do it on our own, because the result, if you don't, could be quite devastating, not just for your patient, but for yourself.
So just listening to you, and if you're somebody that is caring for someone else at the moment and may be feeling that you need help, make sure you find that support network for you, whether it's a group that you can meet up with, maybe it's other people that have been through something similar, maybe it's about finding a hobby or interest that's completely different to what you're going through at the moment, but helps you take your mind off things and take you away for an hour or so until you go back to that caring role. role. But what's most important is the carer needs to be cared for as much as the person being cared for. And to leave you with this, and really heartwarming, sad but heartwarming as well, one of our listeners texted in earlier to say, I had the opportunity to visit my grandmother's sister in her last days as she was dying with cancer in the USA. And this really relates to a lot of what we're talking about with regards to living as expatriates and how connected or what we can do to get involved when people are in the home country and ill or even dying. They say, I was having a hard time with the family. This person was having a hard time with their family dying with cancer in the USA. She called my mum and that she said that nothing gave her more strength than my simple visit. So going all the way to the States to visit that grandma's sister, the sister, the relative, when they were dying of cancer, that meant so much to that individual. So I guess that's something for us all to think about, what it can mean to somebody else, you taking a bit of time and care for someone.